All right, so I want to talk tonight about the parami of renunciation, relinquishing, simplification, disentangling, whatever word you want to use that means letting go or letting be. And I want to recognize that there's a huge range in the practice of renunciation. The word itself might be activating for some because it might have its roots in Judeo-Christian tradition. And so for some people that feels like it's a difficult place. So however you want to translate this word for yourself so it's relatable, do that. I personally like the word renunciation because I like its specificity around what can I release, what can I disentangle from, what can I disarm inside myself. Lots of ways of thinking about it. And I think when we really work with cultivating this as a heart quality, right? So the paramis are qualities of the heart, flavors of love. We're coming very close into the truth of impermanence, that everything absolutely does change. In fact, Suzuki Roshi said, true renunciation is not giving up things of the world, but knowing they go away. It's a very nice perspective. True renunciation is not about giving things up, but knowing they go away. Another way that I like to think of this, this comes from Terry Tempest Williams, brilliant writer. She's got this gorgeous book of essays called Erosion. And a phrase that she uses is, we are eroding and evolving at once. We are eroding and evolving at once. And this is true, and I'll talk more about it a little later on. But what are these parts of us that do release, that we grow out of? And what evolves, what grows in its place? It's worth thinking about that. So many years ago, I got this really beautiful Patagonia catalog in the mail. Anybody ever get Patagonia? So, you know, it's full of very beautiful photography of gorgeous outside places, all of which I want to go to. And, you know, they sell really nice, high quality clothing and gear. And I agree with their politics. They are very good stewards. So this catalog came. And on the cover of this catalog shows a man who was extremely fit, not wearing much clothing, like little trail running shorts. And he was coming up, cresting the top of a hill. And this is like, not a hill, a mountain. And in the background is just like Bill's picture, but higher up. Blue sky, alpine lake. And the guy is sweaty, and you can tell he's been running a long time, cresting, and there's wildflowers. And the caption of this catalog across, in big letters across the front, says, suffer better. Suffer better. And I thought it was so funny and so brilliant. So if I buy all this stuff, I too can go on an impossible trail run that I could never run, but I would have all this cool stuff. And so I could enter the suffering, I could experience the suffering better outfitted. So I thought to myself, you know, whoever came up with that tagline was either a Buddhist or really a brilliant marketer, to suffer better. And it's an interesting thing to think about. What is our relationship to consumption as it relates to, do we let go? Can we let be? How do we simplify? The whole big, huge question about what is enough? Can we be satisfied with what we have? Can we want and be happy with what we have? And all, you know all of the marketing that goes on around, you need this, you need this, you'll be better then, after you buy whatever the thing is. So one of the practices that I love in working with enoughness being satiated is a practice that I don't know if it's really called this, but I've heard it called Five Bites from Full. Anybody familiar with Five Bites from Full? You may be, maybe not. So, oftentimes when we're eating, you're just eating. I'm just eating. It is not my greatest moment of awareness. And especially if there are other people at the table and there's conversation going on, and it's just one bite after the next. And before I know it, I realize I've eaten all the food on my plate. I haven't really tasted a lot of it except for the first couple of bites. And I might have that sense of being overly full. I know you can relate to this. So, a beautiful awareness practice, mindfulness practice, is to be extremely attentive to the practice of eating. Take a bite of your food and put your utensil down and leave it down until you've chewed your food, actually tasted it, notice the sensations of chewing and the food in the mouth, and swallow it, and then pick up your utensil for the next bite. I can do this for two or three bites before I'm somewhere else. I really do find this to be one of the hardest practices. But the beauty of this is that if you really do this, you can notice when you're satisfied. Not necessarily full, but satisfied that you've had enough. And it is a way to work with the practice of renunciation, to work with enough. Now, I want to say really clearly that the experience of enough is often deeply influenced in our lives by, did we grow up with enough? The whole spectrum of prosperity and scarcity. And some people grow up with literally not enough food. And so this may be a more difficult practice and maybe not appropriate for some because it activates that sense of, I was always hungry when I went to school. So I'm not saying everybody should do this. I'm just giving you an example of how can we notice, even if you imagine where are you on the spectrum of prosperity and scarcity, we all have a bit of a set point in that. And there may be certain categories in which we feel more prosperous or more scarce. There may be, it could be, what is your state of health? What is your state of shelter? What is it? I mean, what about friends? What about all kinds of things we can apply this to? So that experience of five bites from full, put it in context if it makes sense to you, but also hear it as it might not make sense for everybody. But I think that we are touching on in this practice of renunciation around what is enough. And to VR's point, am I good enough? Am I heard often enough? Lots of ways we can talk about this. And when we're talking about renunciation practice, we are talking about it from in a Buddhist sense. How do the energies of greed and ill will and confusion hang out in us? It is an exploration. It's also an exploration of cultivating non-greed, not letting ill will take up residence in your heart. Is a practice of renunciation. It doesn't mean you like everything. It doesn't mean things might not be, they may be painful, but not holding a grudge or releasing a grudge, just like in this poem I read. Have you ever had the experience of maybe holding on to some grudgy thing, and then all of a sudden you realize one day you're not holding it anymore? It transformed. Sometimes that can happen. But this is a practice of knowing how to disentangle from it. And we need lots of practices for it. Metta is very, very helpful. Such a beautiful practice of, as the Dalai Lama says, internal disarmament. And I think that much of renunciation practice is a disentangling, an internal disentangling from that which grips us. So let's talk a little bit about typical kinds of renunciation. First is the things, the stuff. You know, getting rid of stuff. I need this, I need that. We all know what that's like. You know, or the desire, the bucket list desire. How long is any person's bucket list of the places I must see in my life? Maybe you have it, maybe you don't. And I'm qualifying that very specifically because not everybody does. So can we let go of that greedy graspiness of, I want this, I want that? And that's why I brought up Suffer Better, Five Bites from Full. I love looking at those beautiful catalogs. I love the fantasy of, I mean, sometimes it's not a fantasy. I mean, you know, sometimes I get stuff. And it's really fun to go on some sort of trip that I've been wanting to go on with my new stuff. So that happens, and that's fine. It's the awareness that we want to bring to it. Awareness of the urge to consume, the urge not to. In Sylvia Boorstein's book, Pay Attention for Goodness Sake, which is a very beautiful exploration of the paramis, this is what she says. I need to keep discovering that the pain of the struggle is greater than the pain of the desire. If I develop the habit of restraining myself, I'll enjoy the relief of feeling desires pass, and I'll remember that desires are not the problem. Feeling pushed around by them is. Isn't that true? It's such an important distinction, because we know that there's one desire after the next, after the next, after the next. And there are different kinds of desires, of course, the wholesome desires and the unwholesome desires. And our practice is to understand the difference. So, you know, a really very everyday kind of example of this, of how we can get hijacked or pulled away by desire. I love this one because it happens. Maybe you've been out to lunch with a friend and you're perfectly satisfied after lunch and going for a walk, and you walk by a bakery, and out of this bakery is wafting the smell of chocolate croissants just out of the oven. But you just had lunch and you're totally fine. But you make a beeline and you're going to go into the bakery and get one of those amazing chocolate croissants, because the desire has that effect in us. So maybe you get the cookie or the croissant, or maybe you don't, but the key here from a practice point is noticing the hook. Being aware enough to notice that hook and then make your decision. Like, so what if you go get it? Okay, be aware of the decision-making process itself. So you can all get what I'm talking about, letting go of stuff, letting go of the need to experience this or that. And it doesn't mean don't do any of it. It means bring some awareness to it. So another aspect of renunciation practice is relationships, people. Can we let go of how we want others to be? VR's rolling our eyes. It's hard work. Can we let go of our views of how we think others should be? Maybe yes, maybe no. What a great gift to give to somebody that says, I love you. You know, this is who you are. To not need to change somebody else, because actually we can't, right? I mean, we really can't. But we can struggle and suffer mightily around the desire to, the constriction that we feel about it. And then it's really hard, you know, that gets a little bit more painful and more difficult when we do need to let go of relationships, or we are let go of in relationships. There's the pain of that, right? There's the sadness of that. And then we meet that with the heart of love that says, yes, this is true. Things change. But I didn't want this one to change. You know, it's hard when a friendship, one person leaves a friendship, not to mention a marriage. Or what about a job? The relationships that are lost. You know, I think about, I'm not talking specifically, but we can, about when an individual maybe is let go from a job. But think about in some of these bigger settings with huge layoffs. What is happening to all those relationships that people have cultivated and what people depend on in all of those dynamics that support one's life? All of a sudden, you know, 2,000 people get laid off. How does one make sense of that kind of letting go when it's not something we've chosen? So this is tough. This is an area of practice that is complex. So now we get to the next level of difficulty here. Views and opinions, right? Views and opinions. The problem with fixed views. The Buddha said, those who cling to their views go about the world annoying others. Those who cling to their views go about the world annoying others. It's kind of true, isn't it? So how do we meet our views? We all have them. We have views and we have opinions, and we often are quite loyal to them. And it takes a lot of work to open up and let go of needing to know or of needing to be right. This is, again, is a really big practice. Even in the Metta Sutta, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one having clarity of vision is not born again into this world. The ability to say, what else is happening here? To not have to hold a view so tightly that we get constricted mind or rigid heart and we put others out of our hearts. But this is not easy. But this is part of the work of renunciation practice. Really, what we're doing is renouncing ill will. We don't have to agree. Acceptance is not agreement. And this is a really important part of how we engage. And we live in such a polarized time that this is all very obvious what I'm saying. What about something as practical as in a relationship, one person is a meditator and the other isn't? And as far as we want people to be the way we want them to be, does it matter if the other person isn't a meditator? Maybe they have another way of cultivating clarity and balance, insight. Can we let that be? So of course, you know, the phrase, let it go, isn't so easy. But can we let things be? To let go of needing to change somebody, to shift a situation to exactly how we want it. Knowing what we can affect, what we can't affect. But within this, to have a quality of care. I think this is really an important piece. Is keeping a quality of caring about each other. There's a beautiful equanimity meditation that sometimes I practice with maybe I do have a very different way of being than somebody else who I actually care about, and it's actually causing a little dukkha. The phrases go like this: I have my path, you have your path, and I care about you. I have my path, you have your path, I care about you. That helps get rid of the gunk and to get to the point of actually we care about each other. That's the love that is necessary. In 2015, Pope Francis, in his Lent homily, said, "Can we give up indifference? Can we give up indifference?" And I think this is a very important piece in the teachings around we come into community with a commitment to care. That's what our precepts are about, right? The precepts are about undertaking a training to take good care of ourselves and each other, and to care about the welfare of another, to not be indifferent. And so how do we do this? Again, we come back to Terry Tempest Williams in her book, Erosion. She says, if we are to flourish as a species, an erosion of belief will be necessary that says we are not the center of the universe, but a dynamic part on an expanding and contracting future that celebrates and collaborates with uncertainty. I think this is really brilliant. If we are to flourish as a species, an erosion of belief will be necessary that says we are not the center of the universe, but a dynamic part on an expanding and contracting future that celebrates and collaborates with uncertainty. Can we get out of our own way? We are so self-referential. We're all the center of our own world. But can we, for a little bit, get out of that space, an erosion of belief that says everything is uncertain, everything is going to change, and can we celebrate that? Can we say, all right, can we engage and participate in this changing world? Part of how we have to do it is to not hold our views so tightly. An erosion of belief will be necessary. And then maybe what we need also in another aspect of renunciation practice is to let go of, I want to be careful about this. I was going to say to let go of fear. There's a lot to be fearful of in our world. But this is more about, can we stay curious? Can we stay open? Can we be willing to blow it? To not always know? To not be right necessarily? Can we trust? To see how struggle, how the dukkha happens, how difficulty is true, and we tend to make it worse. We tend to make it worse because we don't like things to be uncomfortable, or we're afraid of how things might be. And so many things get in the way of our ability to disentangle all of the worldly winds, the vicissitudes, the pain, the pleasure, the gain, the loss, the praise, the blame, the fame, the shame. And we could talk for a long time about how each of those work. But we want pleasure. We don't want to lose. We don't want pain. Shame, I heard a really great acronym recently. The acronym of shame is should have already mastered everything. Should have already mastered everything. How ridiculous. I don't know what the opposite is for fame. First already mastered everything. I don't know. I don't know what it is. But like these opposites, these polarities, they don't work. Because they do, these energies do come and go, and we end up having so many opinions about the shame, the fame, how all of this goes. And so coming back to that piece from Suzuki Roshi, renunciation means everything is going to change. Things go away, including energies, including opinions. Have you noticed as you've matured in your life, a difference of how you treat your own opinions? Like, I think that, you know, typically in our younger years, we might be a little more black and white. We get a lot wiser and more nuanced as we age. We just do. We just do. So here's another piece from Terry Tempest Williams about eroding and evolving at once. We are eroding and evolving at once. What is real, given what we know? I trust what I see in an erosional landscape. Weathering agents are real. Water freezes and shatters stone. Rocks fall from the force of gravity. New rapids appear in rivers. Storms gather and floods roar through dry washes, cutting and scouring a wider channel and changing the course of water. Perhaps this is what is happening to us. We are being worn down to our essence as we are forced to change course. We need not lose hope. We just need to locate where it dwells. So this is the practice of renunciation, to let ourselves maybe come apart a little bit, not be so sure. Can we be wrong? Can we soften into the place where we grow? You know, righteousness, rightness has a rigidity to it. And unfortunately, our culture says right is good and wrong is bad. But to not know is not bad. To make a mistake is not bad. Where do we grow? We grow in those spaces. We can't grow in those rigid places of righteousness. And so we can take some confidence out of our practice to know that we are training, pardon me, we are training to live with this uncertainty, to know it's all shifting, to disentangle from what doesn't support us, to be willing to question my own views. Am I holding things so tightly? Or can I open up a little bit? And can I trust that I can do this practice? There are a couple of different translations of the Buddha's penultimate teaching in the Mahaparini Nibbana Sutta, the sutta he gave right before he died. And it's often translated as whatever is of the nature to arise is of the nature to cease, right, around impermanence. And he went on to say, strive on with diligence. Keep at it. But I recently read another translation that I just love so much. Things fall apart. Tread the path with care. Things fall apart. Tread the path with care. That's what we need to do. We really need to care. And it will support the disentangling of greed and ill will and confusion and support the development of non-greed, compassion, kindness, non-ill will, and clarity. Because we know the truth of dukkha, we know the truth of impermanence, and that what we do matters. We're all so profoundly interconnected. So we need to tread this path with care. So that's what I have for you tonight. Thank you for listening. We've got time to talk with each other. I didn't get to the part of sharing my screen, but it's okay. So, who would like to speak? Bowman or Sherry? Looks like Sherry. Is Sherry or Sherry? I'm so sorry. Sherry. Go Sherry. For it.
Hey, that was really, really beautiful. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
It's kind of changed my relationship to renunciation a little bit, in that it's a little bit more about the awareness and not so much of the success or failure of actually.
I think so.
Yeah.
And, I think it is.
Yeah. And you also talked about the letting it go. And I struggled with that for years. And I think what I'm learning through the Dharma is that it's not that I'm letting go of a situation or a conflict. I'm just letting go of my grip on it.
100%, Sherry. That is what it is. Because it takes away the imperative to have a value judgment on it. It's doing this. It's just releasing that grip a little bit.
Yeah, and in releasing that grip, what I've noticed is that I don't feel safe.
Yeah, good point. Yes.
So to have a little bit of renunciation about, you know, I have to feel safe. It's okay to feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And that uncertainty that you were talking about, it's perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I want to keep going on this thing about feeling safe. It's a big topic because we build up a construct of what we need to feel safe. And it is important to be safe. It is important to feel safe. But where are those edges that we can push out and actually know, I'm okay. I'm actually okay. I have the capacity and the tolerance to push my edges a little bit. And that's freeing. That's really freeing. You know, Karen Mazin Miller, she's a Zen priest in Los Angeles. And I remember she once said, freedom is instantaneous the moment we accept the way things are. Instantaneous. So if we can say, okay, this is what's happening, it doesn't mean I'm not safe. It means I'm expanding a little bit and I'm okay. I have this capacity. It's an important piece around safety. Another thing around that comes to mind around the essential need for limits and boundaries that are important in relationships and in general. I was listening to somebody speak on morality, ethics recently, and they were talking about it as ethical alignment as opposed to literally the precepts and whatever other word it was. But what this person said was, if I am ethically aligned, I don't have to worry about my boundaries. And if we are in relationship with those with whom we are ethically aligned, we know we're not going to hurt each other, so we're safe. It's an interesting way to think about that. That when we agree, we have this alignment about our value system, that I make a commitment not to intentionally harm you, and you make that commitment to not intentionally harm me, I don't have to worry about all my boundaries. They're just naturally cared for. I'm glad you brought that up, Cherie, because it got me on that roll.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome. Deborah.
First of all, I want you to take this talk to Congress.
You're right. Yeah, like, you're right. I actually taught in Congress once.
Did you really?
I did.
That's fabulous. Well, I would like you to take this talk about not clinging so hard to our views and questioning our opinions. Take it to Congress. But no, seriously, you hit on so many cogent. This was fabulous. Thank you. I
mean, thank you. You're welcome.
Fabulous. But you hit on so many points that I have been dealing with just in the last few days. And when you said, think of one thing, one, you know, habit you'd like to let go of, my first thing, not that there is just one, but eating too quickly.
Yeah.
Not chewing enough. And it was hysterical to me when you brought that up. And so thank you for that. And I was very ardent about my opinions and views when I was younger.
Yeah.
And I probably still am, but not so much. The edges have really softened. And a young person I know, a young woman in her 30s who has a son, and long story, she was confiding some stuff to me the other day. And I know I'm not her. Our lives are completely different. I could be her grandmother. And I told her that when she asked me my opinion, so that I could give her what my thoughts on that topic were letting her know that whatever she chose, it had nothing to do with me. It was who she was and where she was at in her life. And I align that with what you talked about, the chocolate croissant, you know, knowing what you're doing when you're doing it.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it is. And also, you know, empowering somebody else to touch into their own wisdom. And it is something that we do offer to people who are younger than us, that it, what an honor that somebody comes and says, what do you think? And we say, you know, I trust you to make a good decision. I trust you to do what you need. It is the awareness of that. Thank you, Deborah. Who else? VR.
I what I thought about when you were talking about enoughness and fear, I just had this flash of how our culture is so designed to teach us to be afraid that we don't have enough.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It is, that's the thing about capitalism. It is continually perpetuating a culture of scarcity. 100%.
And for me, that it's really helpful to have that in my head. Then when stuff comes up, I kind of go like, well, is that how I feel? Or is that how I have been trained to feel?
It's a great question. What a great question for all of us. Is that actually how I feel? Or is it how I've been trained to feel? Yeah, really important. And this comes back to the Buddha's Kalama Sutta. Actually, I'm going to see if I can grab that, and then we're going to end on that. Hang on 1 minute. Okay, so, you know, the sutta that says, find out for yourself. Find out for yourself from your direct experience. Here's one of the translations of that sutta. It is indeed fitting to be uncertain. It's fitting to doubt. For in situations of uncertainty, doubts surely arise. You should decide not by what you've heard, not by following convention, not by assuming it is so, not by relying on the texts, not because of reasoning, not because of logic, not by thinking about explanations, not by acquiescing to the views that you prefer, not because it appears likely, and certainly not out of respect for a teacher. When you would know for yourself that greed, ill will, and ignorance are unhealthy and inclined towards harm and suffering, you should reject them. But when you know for yourself that non-greed, non-ill will, non-delusion are healthy and inclined towards welfare and happiness, then you should stay with them. This is what we're doing, is seeing how this works for ourselves. And there are a lot of things we've learned that work, that we experience, that it is right to care. Cultivating a caring heart matters.